today on Against the Grain. Do protest marches work? It's a tactic the left returns to again and again since the iconic March on Washington in 1963. Grassroots organizer L.A. Kaufman argues that they do have a positive impact, but not in the ways we usually expect. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll discuss protests and mass marches then and now with her. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Mass marches have been a signature tactic of the American left since the early 1960s. But have they yielded diminishing returns? That's a question explored in L.A. Kaufman's book, How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance. She's a grassroots organizer who has also written about direct action, and she joins me from Brooklyn. You were involved as an organizer in some of the biggest protests in history, those against the Iraq War. And yet those protests didn't stop the U.S. from invading Iraq. And that seemed a turning point for a lot of activists who stopped going to marches after that. The form seemed empty, especially marching around a vacant downtown or financial district on a Saturday morning. Many activists concluded that it was no longer a tactic that worked. Now, of course, we've seen mass demonstrations again, including the Women's March when Trump was inaugurated. But the question remains, do protests still work?
That is the key question. And I usually start off by distinguishing between different kinds of protests, because protests aren't all alike and they don't all work the same way. So when you're asking if they work or not, it's really begging the question of work how. Obviously, those Iraq anti-war protests did not stop the war. And mass protests, on the whole, don't work very well as short-term pressure tactics, at least not mass protests as they've evolved in the United States. There are exceptions around the world that are more like a mass uprising and less like a permanent march. But, you know, that question was what really led to the writing of this book. Was I was centrally involved in those huge anti-war marches in 2003, 2004. And from some points of view, you know, from the kind of internal perspective of organizing, they felt like enormous successes in terms of the number and range of groups that came together, the talent and energy that so many people put into those days of action, the incredible numbers of people we were able to mobilize out in the streets in a very short period of time. And yet the fact that they failed in their short-term objective of ending the war, which may have been an unattainable objective no matter what, did, as you say, have a long hangover for the American left. And the anti-war movement, you know, in contrast to the anti-war movement against the Vietnam War, which started very small and built over time, the anti-war movement against the Iraq War started huge and then dwindled steadily for years, which is a very dispiriting situation to be in. And what, you know, so for years I was haunted by that and by certainly, you know, the sense that it's important when thinking about protests not to confuse size with impact, because they don't always correlate. But wondering what there was of value in that form. I didn't question whether it was right for us to stand up against the war. Of course it was. Of course it was right for us to do what we could, even if we couldn't win. But, you know, could we have been doing something effective? And is there something of value in these mass marches? And that's where, you know, what really sparked this book was the experience of going to the Women's March in 2017, the day after Trump's inauguration in Washington, D.C., and saying, wow, there's something really different going on here. And then tracing how that very different kind of mobilization has had enduring effects now, 2 years into the Trump presidency.
Well, we'll talk a lot about protests in the present period, but let's back up and talk about the history of mass protests in the U.S., which you look at in your book, How to Read a Protest, starting with the 1963 March on Washington, which took place a year before the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and is held up as an almost mythical event in U.S. history, How did that protest, how much of an impact now looking back, do historians think that the protest had on the passage of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, the consensus among historians, when you hear the kind of classic mainstream media story that is framed, do protests still work, which is usually framed for the answer to be no, that protests don't still work. The 63 March is always held up as this shining example of effective protest, and both because of the grandeur and power of the day, the power of Dr. King's words, the ways it continues to inspire, but also the sense that it led to that landmark crucial legislation in 64 and 65, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. To historians, the relationship between the march and the legislation is really pretty indirect. It's indirect and diffuse, which is the way these things tend to work. But for some reason, subsequent marches sort of aren't allowed to do that. Within days of the gun control marches last spring, there were, all of these reflections. Well, does marching still matter? Is this going to do anything? Does it change anything at all? The same with the women's marches. Did it change anything? Always asked really soon after the march, as if women were going to march on Washington on January 21st and Donald Trump was going to see the light of day and pass, progressive feminist legislation a day after. That's not how it works. These kinds of mobilizations from the first big one, which 63 was, people don't necessarily realize that. It really was the first mass march in America. From 63 onward, the way these things work, it unfolds over a longer time frame. And so it's very difficult when we're in a moment of extraordinary protest, as we are right now, to gauge the effectiveness, a week later or a month later, in policy terms, because the policy impact of these things takes time to be felt.
Sure. And then there's the other question to be explored later, which is also gauging the degree to which, whether the protest was effective, how it might have fed into future social movements as well. But staying with the March on Washington, what was the form of the march? How was it organized? What was the story behind it and its relationship to those in power?
Well, so in my book, I use the signs that are carried at protests as a way into all of these questions about understanding how different protests are organized very differently and how that has very different consequences. And I came upon this focus after being struck by what an incredible percentage of the signs of the 2017 women's marches were handmade. And I was reading up on the 63 March, and I stumbled across a detail that absolutely stunned me, which is that all of the signs were completely controlled by the march leadership. And as someone who had played a leading organizing role in massive marches, that raised two questions immediately. First of all, was how did they do that? Because it's not so easy to control a crowd of a quarter million people. And then in a lot of ways, the more important question was, why did they do that? Why did they want to control everything about the messages that the marchers were carrying? And so as I went into the archives and found, looked through, there's extraordinary records available about the March on Washington, a lot of things about the nuts and bolts of the organizing that haven't much been written about. Interviews with some of the lesser known organizers who played key behind the scenes roles and transcripts of meetings with police officials, that kind of thing. I really got the sense, we're aware that Dr. King played a figure as a charismatic leader in the civil rights movement, a style of leadership that we don't see as much in movements now. But the top down control of the 63 March was really thoroughgoing, emphatic, and very different in style from what we see afterwards. And it went along with, it was partly a response to anxieties and fears about organizing what was the first ever mass march on Washington. They really didn't want anything to go wrong and reflect poorly on the movement. So there was an incredible climate of fear around the march. But they also very quickly got into negotiations with the Kennedy administration that constrained and limited the form of the march. You know, initially it wasn't just going to be a march. Initially it was going to be a march with a lot of direct action attached to it, a lot of civil disobedience. That was what Bayard Rustin wanted to see. And as soon as they start negotiating with the Kennedy administration, it becomes tamer and tamer and more circumscribed. It no longer goes past the march route gets moved to the symbolic sites of the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument, as opposed to going past, say, the Capitol or the White House, and thus, you know, directly bringing grievances to centers of power. The whole event unfolded in this highly controlled, highly orchestrated way that, you know, did provide a very controlled and powerful platform for King's words, and did enable the civil rights movement to make, you know, a very powerful statement. But one of the things that I found when I looked very closely at the records from that day was that it didn't actually strengthen the organizations who put it on, whether you gauge that by their fundraising efforts or their membership, or their reported level of activity. They were all kind of weakened by this effort.
And why do you think that was?
I think it's very familiar to me from having done my own organizing work that I did, is that these big events tend to deplete you. They require so much work to get people there. And the groups that organize them, you know, tend to exhaust themselves from doing so. And so, you know, so they, in D.C., they collected, you know, in 63, they collected 75,000 pledge cards from people who said they wanted to get further involved in the movement. And I think they're still in the same boxes they put them in then. I mean, I found them and looked through them, but, you know, nobody had the energy to follow up. Nobody had the capacity to absorb that new wave of energy into the movement, which, you know, certainly after, you know, we organized the February 15th, 2003 anti-war marches, we didn't, you know, we did have subsequent protests, but we didn't have the energy to incorporate whole waves of new people into the movement, in the Iraq anti-war movement in 2003. To me, staff people have limited energy and capacity to do that work.
Indeed. With the 1963 march in Washington, you're talking about how the forum was really controlled and how there was this concern about the way that the march would appear to the public and to those in power. How controversial was the forum that was settled on at the time?
Malcolm X was very outspoken in his criticism of the march, as were some other figures from the more radical wings of the Black movement. You know, what would develop into the Black Power wing of the movement. This is before Black Power had officially emerged. Some figures from the more direct action wing, like from CORE and SNCC, the groups that had really been on the front lines, using bold direct action on the front lines in the South to fight for voting rights and against segregation and discrimination. You know, a lot of those activists were put off by the orchestrated and heavily policed quality of the March on Washington. I should add what I said, that the signs were controlled. That meant if you showed up with a sign that wasn't approved by the march leadership, they had a force of 2,000 volunteer marshals who were off duty, Black firefighters and police officers, who would surround you and remove you from the march and take your sign away. It wasn't just like they said, hey, we don't want you to bring your own signs. It really was much more tightly controlled than that. And so there, you know, Malcolm X was very fiery in his denunciations. But there were other critiques as well, which were not made public then, but which scholars have written about since, and which were from women who were involved in the organizing effort. They did not make their objections public at the time. But women, first of all, carried a disproportionate share of the work of actually getting people to the march, of that crucial outreach and mobilizing work. And yet, despite repeated efforts and repeated requests, women were completely sidelined from any kind of formal decision-making role in the march's leadership bodies, And from having any voice at the march. There were 10 speakers, all of them men. Dr. King was the last in the line of 10 speakers. Women weren't even allowed, the wives of the leaders weren't even allowed to march with them at the march. If you look at the, there's a famous photograph that I include in the book of the front line of the march being assembled, and it's all men. The women, they were so upset at this. They didn't want to just march behind the men, you know, several steps behind. So they went over to Independence Avenue and organized their own march, their own like contingent, stepping off over there. So that control that's reflected in the character of the signs, you know, had all these other dimensions as well that had, you know, deep political significance.
I'm speaking with grassroots organizer and journalist L.A. Kaufman. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So how much did the March on Washington held up as this emblematic example of a mass protest and the form that it took, which was in many ways defanged, the organizers really straining to show order and not have it be a threatening demonstration? How much did that then influence subsequent mass demonstrations about other issues beyond civil rights in subsequent years and decades?
I mean, it absolutely became the template and the model that every other movement followed. You know, it's very striking. Part of my research for this book, I went back and really looked at what were the largest marches in Washington, what are the largest marches that happened anywhere in the U.S. ever, what were the largest days of protests in U.S. history, and what's striking about the big marches is we've never had a mass march in America that wasn't permitted, negotiated with the authorities, you know, hemmed in, controlled, and tame. And there's very positive reasons to do that with a march. It's really important. Those marches often serve as a kind of on-ramp into the movement and a gathering space, which ideally is a gathering space that welcomes as many people, as many potential supporters as possible, so that that tame quality that was first established by the 63 March on Washington is important for having movements and movement gatherings where, you know, folks with small children or folks with disabilities or folks with, you know, issues about their immigration status can come and participate and know they're not going to risk being arrested, know that they're going to be physically safe. So there's power in that. But we kind of have this idea of them as being pressure tactics. And you can't really exercise pressure, short-term pressure, when an event is so carefully orchestrated and controlled. The targets of the protest know that people are going to march and then they're going to go back home. And that's very different from, you know, the kind of mobilization where people show up and stay, or where people show up day after day, you know, the kinds of things that we've seen, the kinds of protests that we've seen take down authoritarian governments around the world. You know, these one day mass events, they're very powerful or can be at their best for movement building, but they're not, you know, but they don't really leverage power in the way that we sort of assume that they will. And so then those questions of like, do protests work or not, are often based on this gap between, you know, false idea of what they're supposed to accomplish and then what they actually do.
Well, you've written a whole book about direct action and those types of tactics that you're touching on that mass marches do not tend to engage in, such as occupations and disruptive activities that are not sanctioned by the state. Are there examples, though, in looking at the history of mass demonstrations in the United States, of mass demonstrations turning into occasions where direct action is exerted?
Yes and no. I mean, quite a few years there was a very common practice of having like a mass march in Washington on Saturday, and then a day of training on Sunday, and a direct action on Monday, having a whole mobilization that included the mass march as the big inclusive gathering, but then also was connected to some kind of direct action protest. And there was this one mass march in 1970, which is interesting to look at in the Trump era, which was called in a matter of days after the Kent State shootings, which was when the National Guardsmen killed four unarmed protesters at Kent State University who were part of a nationwide wave of massive student protests in the wake of President Nixon's bombing of Cambodia, which was a major escalation of the Vietnam War. So all these protests broke out, the National Guard shoots and kills four protesters, and there's a call for a massive protest in D.C. like 8 days later, which was too short of a time period to even apply for a permit. And there's a very large turnout, but people also decide to pretty much lay siege to the White House. There's this incredible moment where Nixon freaks out and he surrounds the White House with 60 buses parked end to end, and people are there's police all lining this barricade of buses, and a whole bunch of anti-war protesters trying to climb them or crawl under them or go around them or go through them or push them over. This sense of a siege that, it was nonviolent, but it was very powerful, very unlike anything we've ever had happen before or since. And, it shook Nixon up. It was one of the things that made him feel like the Vietnam War, like he needed to find a way out of the Vietnam War. Of course, the war continued for quite some time after that, but it had a very different, stronger impact than the anti-war marches that just showcased the breadth of opposition to the war. That communicated something different, which was the intensity, not just the breadth.
Do you see any difference in mass marches that have taken place to pressure administrations that might be seen as pressurable, thinking about the March on Washington's relationship with Kennedy, to mass protests that have happened against hostile administrations? Nixon is obviously one. Trump comes to mind. Are there ways that they have been different under those differing state administrations, or have they tended to be the same, with the exception of what you've just been discussing in 1970?
Well, I think that, for example, like the massive protests against Bush, there was more of a feeling of shouting into the wind with those protests, whether or not that was in fact the case, and of the protests being necessarily part of a longer term movement building project. There's a bit more of a sense that if you've got a huge number of women mobilizing for reproductive choice when there is, a sympathetic administration, that you're going to at least help, help stiffen their spine. But I think what really jumps out to me is how different the women's marches were in 2017 and how they were never, they emerged as a viral phenomenon, as a groundswell. And part of the framing from the very start, I mean, there was a stumble around the woman who first called for the women's marches, called them the Million Woman March, which right. For a white woman from Hawaii was a very problematic act of cultural appropriation, and there was a lot of pushback.
Because of the Million Men March, which was an African-American march, male march.
Exactly.
In the 90s,
and
was
one
it?
Of the largest marches. It was, yeah, it was in 95, and it still is one of the largest marches that ever happened in U.S. history. And spawned, there were, a series of follow-up events. There was an event called the Million Woman March in Philadelphia. I forget which year. There was pushback around that. But the way that those events were defined from the start was not as anti-Trump protests. No one went to those marches with the illusion that they were going to be pressuring Donald Trump in the short term. They were doing something else. You know, it was a gathering of our side. It was a way of reminding ourselves of the scale and breadth of the opposition to Trump. It was a breaking of silence and fear. It can be hard to remember just how ominous the atmosphere was in the period between Election Day and the inauguration, and how frightened and paralyzed so many people were. And the marches were really powerful in terms of breaking that spell, changing that mood, giving people that bodily sense of our collective power and of the possibility of action. So they really, in a very unique way in the history of mass mobilizations in America, you know, were an opening, beginning, a launching pad for all kinds of organizing to happen in the political space that they had opened up, forming one of the thousands of new groups that were formed in the months after the inauguration. A staggering number of new groups that were founded, whether it was by, you know, making phone calls to Congress or taking part in citizen lobbying, all the way through to the work that people did on a massive scale with the grassroots Get Out the Vote mobilization around the midterms. What seems so different to me is how much the women's marches helped contribute to creating a phenomenon, a space in which so many people, and by people I mean in this case mostly women, it felt like, I don't need to wait for permission, I don't need to wait for, you know, somebody to for invitation. I'm going to do what I did in going to the women's marches in the first place, which is just step up and dig in and begin organizing. And so many people did that and have continued doing that. I think the levels of engagement have continued to be remarkably high, so that now at this point, all of those folks who were newly activated now have almost 2 years of organizing under their belt.
In some ways, it seems that what we've seen since Trump's inauguration has been a flourishing of organizing that's happened not on the radical left necessarily, but in a space where really protests hadn't come out of and a lot of organizing hadn't come out of it. And, you know, one could quibble on the left of what radicals might think of one thing versus another. But would you say there's a shift in that sense since then?
You could call the large pool of people who become activated. It wouldn't be inaccurate to call them liberals rather than radicals. But I think it's important not to label them too definitively, because I think activism organizing changes people. And in particular, I think it radicalizes people to get involved deeply in the contest over power and policy. And I think that the political identities and political perspectives of all this remarkable pool of people who've become active are fluid and shifting. They certainly didn't start out with any kind of left identity. They, you know, their identity would be much more diffusive, like a concerned American. But the experience of engaging in organizing in this time, I think, is deepening people's understandings in ways that, you know, are nudging them to the left.
L.A. Kaufman was the mobilizing coordinator for some of the largest protests in history against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Her other book is Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. One of the things that you do in How to Read a Protest is you go back and look at the numbers for the largest marches in U.S. history in the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st. And it's interesting, of course, how so many of these things then sort of disappear in our collective memory. But you talk about the 1982 anti-nuclear protests, which were enormous, I think a million people in Central Park in New York, the March for Women's Lives in 2004. Just remind us of the scale of protests since the time we're talking about, from the 60s to the present?
Right. Well, so the 63 March, as I said before, really is the very first mass march in America, which is something that I hadn't quite realized before I started working on this book. And, you know, there had been parades and pageants and strikes and protests. There had been, you know, many kinds of organizing and unrest, but the particular tactic of the mass protest march had not happened. And then in the four decades since, there are dozens and dozens of them. Part of what's interesting when I look back over, I compiled a list, a chart that's in this book, a lot about these protests have really been very understudied. I had to reconstruct the numbers to put together these charts, and those numbers are highly contested. It's very difficult to get a fix on how many people are at a protest. All the sources are unreliable ones. They're either the government that wants to underestimate, or the organizers who want to overestimate, or sure, the media who wants to underestimate or just flubs it. But it's very striking to me when you look over the list of, you know, what the biggest couple of dozen marches are in U.S. history, and it's really identity politics, right? It's really, it's feminist movements, it's the lesbian and gay movement. It is some of these, issue-focused mobilizations around nuclear weapons, nuclear power, around gun control. But, you know, there's only one labor mobilization of any size. There's only one. And it was really at a moment of decline and defeat. It was right after Ronald Reagan took office, and in what became a real turning point for organized labor, had fired a group of striking air traffic controllers. And there was this one Solidarity Day march. It's not like organized labor hasn't played a role in other mobilizations, but, you know, we kind of have these ideas about who does mass organizing, and there's a certain rhetoric in certain segments of the left about mass movements and mass mobilizing. We hear a lot of that from the socialist left, and it's, you know, and how, you know, we should be unifying the left in the mass movement. And when you look and see who's actually brought the numbers to DC, it was, you know, identity-based movements, really, by and large.
And why do you think that is?
I think that's where the energy and momentum have been on the left for the last 40 years. My first book is about that to a great extent. When I talk about the reinvention of American radicalism, I'm really talking about how a sprawling movement of movements that, you know, is galvanized by identity politics is the landscape of activism in our time, that there is no such thing as a unitary left. And those who inhabit and advocate that identity are, you know, usually not in the main waves of mobilizing in our time.
When we think of mass marches, we think of the left, but what about mass marches on the right? Is there a history of mass marches during the same period?
No. The right doesn't really mirror our tactics that often. They use different tactics. I mean, there are certainly examples. I mean, I think the alt-right has been borrowing very heavily from left-wing tactics of direct action. Mm-hmm. And I cringe knowing that some of them have read my book and use that for insights in how to do provocative actions, that force a crisis. The right really doesn't do mass marches. I mean, the closest thing would be, you know, the anti-abortion things that happen every January. I haven't looked really closely at the numbers on those, but the numbers on those have never really rivaled the kinds of things that you know, have happened on our side. I do wish somebody was, and maybe somebody is, closely tallying the numbers of Trump's rallies during his presidency, because I think those are very striking and different, and the scale of those is quite significant and different from things we've seen in the past. But the right doesn't, you know, when they march, it's not in big numbers.
You write in your book, and you mentioned earlier, that size does not necessarily equal impact. Explain what you mean and give us some examples.
the fact that you mobilize a crowd of 250,000, 500,000, 800,000 doesn't mean you have that many times more the power that you would have if you had 1,000 people engaging in a different kind of protest. You know, I think of ACT UP as the key example of a movement that never drew large numbers. Their very largest actions had maybe 10,000 people, maybe 20 if you're generous. But they never, you know, there was never a, I mean, obviously there was a showing of the AIDS quilt and issues around, you know, HIV and AIDS were important in the big gay mobilizations that happened over time in DC. But there never was like an AIDS focused mass march. Those AIDS actions were much smaller. And in many cases, the actions that ACT UP engaged in, you know, would have 50 people or 350 people or, you know, 500 people. But they were very carefully targeted actions. They were part of strategic campaigns that unfolded over time. They were done in ways that married bringing outside pressure to bear on institutions while engaging in dialogue with people on the inside to advance policy objectives. So, you know, it's an example of a movement that, you know, never had mass numbers and never even really had majority support. They were pretty marginalized and unpopular because they were rude and they were loud and a lot of Americans were afraid of HIV. And yet they achieved extraordinary victories. There are millions of people alive now who wouldn't be if it hadn't been for their work.
But in the case of ACT UP, you're talking about the difference between small direct action oriented organizing and large mass marches. In a sense, you're comparing different things. When you're looking, as you have done very extensively, at the history of mass marches, and it's a tactic that the left returns to again and again and again, although you're saying that also it's actually quite new, historically speaking, since the 60s, would it be fair to say that as we assess the kind of protest tactics that make sense, that direct action tends to have more of the kinds of impact that people are hoping protest will yield than mass marches?
Yes, but I say that with caveats because it's not, because I don't want to suggest that I think mass marches are unimportant or that in most cases direct action that happens in isolation from a larger mass movement is going to have the effectiveness of direct action that unfolds in relationship to some larger mass movement. So I think that, for instance, you know, the fact that ACT UP emerged at a period and in a period of time when there, you know, also were 650,000 people marching on Washington for lesbian and gay rights mattered. And that larger context of a broader, more diffuse engagement can help in ways large and small strengthen the more targeted and focused protests. You know, part of the thing about these mass marches is that they, you know, they're organized in almost all cases, the large lead time, and they tend to be more, you know, they're more like gatherings than they are usually directly focusing on a specific set of objectives and targets. You know, they're just conceived of and differently. They're more like in the case of the lesbian and gay marches, they were more like milestones in the movement. You know, of course, now the milestones are that it's the milestone of now our movement is totally corporatized and bland and, you know, lacking in any radical critique. But, you know, but, so yeah, so it's kind of like these mass marches are a different kind of phenomenon unto themselves. You know, direct action always is going to attract a smaller number of people. It involves a higher level of risk. There's a higher bar to entry. And but you know, a movement that's engaging in, you know, in confrontational direct action, but doesn't have mass support, just the fact that they're doing direct action doesn't mean that they're gonna win and be more effective.
Sure.
I kind of think of movements a lot of times as ecosystems, you know, and that you know that there's different roles, and that in a healthy ecosystem you have a lot of diversity of forms in life, and I think in a healthy, effective movement you have that as well.
Ellie Kaufman is my guest. We're talking about her book, How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So would it be fair to say then that mass protests, mass marches have a positive effect often, in your opinion, but what comes out of it isn't necessarily the aim of the organizers? In other words, that the organizers are not setting out to bring everyone together in a big gathering that might allow more people to get involved and find their way into other kinds of actions. But that tends to be, when things work, the positive outcome. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are smart and seasoned organizers who know exactly that. I mean, I was lucky enough to work with the great Leslie Kagan, who was the lead coordinator of many of the largest protests in American history. And she's, you know, has no illusions about the limits and possibilities of mass marches. The work that they do is in a lot of ways, you know, movement building work that unfolds over this long time frame. It might be, you know, depending on what the exact march is and with the exact context, it might be, strengthening and expanding a coalition. That's crucial political work, even though that doesn't lead to short-term policy or legislative change. You know, I think that there's a romance around marching on Washington. I mean, it's a thing that happens in our movement more generally. There's a way in which we fetishize tactics. We fall in love with our tactics. And a lot of times our movements define themselves through their tactics.
Sure.
The direct action movements have certainly done that. And there's something, you know, there is a grandeur about being in a massive crowd of people in those great spaces in Washington, D.C. There's a way in which this was certainly part of the motivation for the gay marches. There's a way in which it's like it's validation that your movement exists in a cap, you know, as a capital M movement to be able to pull off a big march on Washington. And, you know, so some of that appeal, you know, is about, you know, how movement sees itself and understands itself. And that, you know, that's not an impact that you can measure in the way that you can impact whether a bill was passed or not. But it matters, I think.
Well, it does seem that people on the left often, as you say, fall in love with their tactics and kind of go back to them again and again without reworking them, rethinking them. And I'm wondering if you think that, since you've said that often mass marches, even though you see positive things coming out of them, you know, often are ritualized, corporatized even, and represent things that might be different than what a lot of the people joining the march think they're there for. Is this a time that we should be really rethinking them and perhaps also blurring the lines between the ways we do things rather than having direct action in one corner, mass marches in another, but they take a particular form. What do you think we should be doing as we think about these tactics today?
Well, that's a big question. I think first of all that the way that mass marches happen has changed, and the way that they've been unfolding in the Trump era is different from the past, because while we continue to have these big mobilizations in Washington, more often than not, they are part of days of action where there are marches all around the country. When the first women's marches happened in 2017, it happened in more than 650 locations, which, as far as I can determine, is you know, not just breaks, but shatters previous records for coordinated days of protest. And so there's a way in which people have already been reinventing that. There's a quote in my book, one of the women who was pushing to be more involved in a leadership role at the 1963 March on Washington was the great organizer Septima Clark, who had run these leadership schools for the Southern Christian Leadership Council all throughout the South, and who was very interested in, you know, developing and encouraging leaderful movements, grassroots leadership. And she, there's this quote where she says, you know, I sent a letter to Dr. King saying maybe he shouldn't lead all the marches, but that we should cultivate leaders who can lead marches, many marches all around the country instead of just one. And Dr. King read the letter out to his staff and they all just laughed. And we've shifted away from a moment where that was laughable to a moment when that's reality, and where these days of action, you know, are moments that are unfolding not just in Washington, D.C., not just in these marquee events that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to mount, and which, you know, I think we should question whether we need as many of them as we have. It becomes this automatic gesture. Maybe we don't need quite so many of them. But the power of this happening in the Trump era in so many different locations. I mean, there have been more than 25,000 different protests since Trump took office, an absolutely stunning number. And I think that level of geographic ubiquity and what it implies in terms of the cultivation of so many different grassroots leaders all around the country has a real power that's different from a lot of the marches that I list in my charts, the big days in Washington that are the one-off in one place, or maybe there's one in, you know, in the West Coast as well as the East Coast. I think what's happening now is different and has its own power and impact.
I want to end by asking you a rather unfair question, because it's not something that you tackle in How to Read a Protest, but it's something I think on the minds of many of us, which is, we can look back at the ways protests have evolved or not evolved over time. But looking into the future, there is a sense of urgency many people have about exerting the kind of pressure that needs to be exerted around the climate crisis, where the timeline for making change is actually extremely short. And there's also a great deal of fear that people have, which can often be demobilizing. Do you have any thoughts about how to organize against what feels like the unthinkable when those in power, and even the party of opposition, are resistant to serious action?
Well, I've certainly been inspired by the Extinction Rebellion that's been unfolding in the UK recently, and which has been a movement that has been using disruptive direct action to call attention to the climate crisis in a way that feels like reflects a necessary escalation. I also am really impressed by the Sunrise Movement, which held that sit-in in Nancy Pelosi's office that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came to and supported, and that was tied to the introduction of this Green New Deal legislation. You know, part of what's been striking about the resistance to Trump, this is something I've written about for The Guardian and other places, is that on the whole, until pretty recently, though we've had massive numbers of people in the streets, we haven't had a lot of direct action, haven't had a lot of large-scale direct action. It's mostly been permitted marches and rallies and protests and citizen lobbying and that kind of thing. And I think the urgency, you know, the thing about disruptive protest is, you know, it's, you have to use disruption sparingly in movements, but it's disrupting business as usual is one of the best ways we have of conveying a sense of emergency when normal life is continuing unperturbed. And so given how high and devastating the stakes are, already we have signs that people are doing that already, and I hope that we're going to see much more of that you know, the juggernaut feels like it's going in the wrong direction. But that kind of escalated direct action is one of the tools we have to try to turn things around.
And why do you say we need to use disruption sparingly?
Because it can trigger backlash. Because particularly the kind of disruption that disrupts the lives of ordinary people rather than the lives of decision maker. I think the kind of disruption that disrupts the lives of decision maker we should use liberally. The kind of disruption that involves like blocking bridges, paralyzing a city center, that kind of thing. It's powerful. It's important. And it also inconveniences people, you know, who are not our enemies, who are not our opponents. And if we're not careful with that kind of direct action, it can spark a backlash. It's okay to spark a little bit of backlash. You don't go out and protest to be popular or win a popularity contest. There are usually people who find what you're doing, you know, abrasive and off-putting, and that's okay. You know, it's good to just paralyze a city sometimes, but it's even better to, you know, to disrupt ordinary life for, you know, our opponents as directly as possible.
I'll need to have you back to talk more about this and your direct action book. Ellie Kaufman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
Ellie Kaufman has been my guest. She's a grassroots organizer and journalist, author of How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance. And if you go to againstthegrain.org, you'll find a link to it. That's out from UC Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.